Okay, so without further ado, we've got Lost in Tech Translation from Lucy Chambers.
Thanks, Adam. Can you hear me? Yeah, okay, fantastic.
Move forward, Tom.
I apologise, I had some vaccinations earlier in the week and was not very well yesterday, so I'm going to try and hold it together for long enough to do this talk. So this talk was inspired actually by a recent career move for the previous 4 years up to about January this year. I was working for the Open Knowledge Foundation, or Open Knowledge as it's now called, and working on lots of things around government transparency, supporting journalists, NGOs, teaching them how to do data stuff. And I recently went freelance. I recently became a product manager, and I've started working for an organisation called eHealth Africa, and we do all kinds of things about public health supporting things like vaccine delivery, making sure that there aren't bottlenecks in places like that. And somebody said to me, somebody from my previous world of work said to me, "Oh, it must be so nice to work on well-defined problems." And it got me thinking. I was like, "Hang on, how can public health stuff be?" Oh, is it on?
Hello. Yes.
Does that actually help? No. I'm just going to try and project.
Try this one.
And now?
No.
Now. Okay. So it got me thinking. I was like, okay, so these are genuinely complicated problems that I'm working on. Why would you say something to me like that? But it must be nice to work on a well-defined problem. And I started thinking about what type of problems it is that we face and whether there is any way of working out whether it is a good idea or not, to throw technology at them. So today I do not intend to tell you anything that you don't know already. I might, however, be able to offer you some words to talk about problems and to categorise them a little bit in a way that is at least helpful for me. And I'm gonna yay. Okay, so my name is Lucy Chambers, and I have problems, plenty of them. I collect them, in fact. Tech translation was just a very generic term that I used when I was thinking of switching career. I said that basically the thing that I really, really liked doing was taking talking to real people and talking to techies and seeing if I could somehow bridge the gap. And all of the career advice that I got was you should go and do product management. This is the thing for you. So I recently started writing about some of the discoveries, and you can find that on the blog, which is tech2human.com. So one of the things that the way that I try and structure my writing is I try and expose some of the naiveties of my previous ways of thinking, because I figure that if I didn't know something, if something wasn't self-explanatory to me 4 years ago, it probably wasn't self-explanatory to other people as well. So the one that I'm going to talk about today is problems, the nature of problems. And the naive thought that I used to have in my head was that I used to think that people were employed to be creative. I thought that I used to think that that was my reason for being. I thought that I would have to come up with some solution to something that was going to nail it better than anything else that anybody else could ever hope to do. What actually I've come to realise is that problem definition is such an important part of the work that we do when we work in tech that it kind of merits. Being a substantial part of somebody's job role. So luckily, in a product management role, I do get the chance to spend a lot of time doing about this. And not everybody is in a position to have a dedicated product manager, but This is just this is a talk about how it might be worth thinking about how you can give somebody space to do the problem definition, even if you don't have a dedicated person. So that was my naive thought, and then this is the nearest thing that I have come to a solution for how to kind of break through actually speeding up problem definition. So this is basically what I do. Trying to work out who has what problem, which ones technology can actually solve, and, which is kind of crucial, defining what success looks like. So it's not actually my job. It's not actually my job to come up with the smartest solution and say that it's going to be written in Django, it's going to be based off Django, and in Python, and it's going to have an API. It's purely, I have to have some kind of orientation and know enough about technology to know what is feasible to be solved with technology, but it is a far better use of my time to spend more time defining problems. So, this is my simple taxonomy for how I think about problems in the world. Number one, so these are basically three distinctions. Some of which, so a problem can fit into all or none of these. Well, hopefully at least one of them, otherwise it's not a very successful taxonomy. Sorry?
Such a problem.
In very 90s style, I went for an animated slide. Because I figured you hadn't seen it, all right. Okay, so a problem is either known or it's unknown. We only really deal with problems that we know about. Things will probably come through and bite us in the ass later, which are the unknown problems. They're either generic or they're unique. So they're either something which has been encountered in another scenario, or something that's genuinely a idiosyncratic little beast that is only... In the particular solution that you're looking at. So if it's generic, then clearly you might be able to go and see if there's other open source software that can help you with it. And the one that I want to spend a little bit more time on is this distinction. So tame or wicked. So I only learned this term very recently, but I think it's actually really helpful when we're thinking about some of the things that we're tackling in this tech for good. In this tech for good space. So for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to define tame as a tame problem as anything that is not a wicked problem. And then we're going to look a bit more about what actually what constitutes a wicked problem. So a wicked problem is a social problem in which the various stakeholders can barely agree on what the definition of the problem should be, let alone what the solution is. In the original formulation of wicked problems, there's like 10 categories, but these are the ones that I thought were most relevant. So you quite often end up with lots and lots of stakeholders involved, lots of opinions, a large economic burden. They're tied up with all different things. I'll give you some examples in a second. Quite often, the only way that you, if you're working on a wicked problem, the only way that you end up stopping is if you run out of money. So there's no other reason. You don't necessarily know that you've solved it any other way. So some examples, things like tackling climate change, recovering from a financial crisis, solving political instability, the latter two being the type of things that I would previously have dealt with. So solutions to those are not right or wrong. And particularly I think in political contexts, you get like one go a lot of the time because a lot of what we do is a combination of tech and campaigning. Like the tactics that we use, quite often if we use them one time, we can't necessarily use them the second time because it changes the game. Like they know what we're going to do next time. So those are kind of like overarching those are the overarching kind of types of problems. And clearly, you can define problems at any level. You can like define headline problems. But the thing that is really interesting when we're talking about whether a problem is suitable to be tackled by tech, I think, is the root cause, like the root cause problem. So you have to kind of ask why. Apparently, there's some theory that if you ask why five times, you get to what the root cause of the problem is. And when you and when you are at that root cause point, then that's the point that you can ask, okay, is this something that technology can actually solve, or is it a people problem, or is it a process problem? Because of that, so as you can kind of tell, you can be swimming in this, in these problems, some of which are incredibly, incredibly complicated, some of which are wicked. How do we know which ones we're actually going to be prepared to tackle? So I would like to offer you one further distinction, which is something that I find kind of useful, and that is crunchy. So I use the word crunchy because you can kind of feel it. It's a tangible thing. It's not fluffy. It's not abstract. It's like the feeling of leaves underfoot in autumn. So when you get to the point that something is crunchy, and that's the point that you can have the conversation about whether you should be tackling or not. And so my definition of crunchy has multiple different parts, but the main one is that I can imagine at least one problem or headache. I'm glad that Tony is sat at the front because I stole the word headache from him. Of a person who is affected in some way by this problem. That means that I need to at least be able to imagine the face of a real person who is affected in some way by this problem, otherwise I won't touch it. Some other things that go into the definition of crunchy. Do I have a hypothesis for how I'm actually going to be able to change it? Do I know why it should be me that is tackling this problem? And why now? Then the final one is, do I have a epitaph for my project? Or do I actually have multiple epitaphs? I think that's the right word. Vaccination brain, it's not going very well. One of the problems with dealing with wicked problems and complicated problems in general, where people don't agree on what the definition of the solution will be, is that you don't necessarily know when to stop, and you can spend your entire life burning out, flogging this thing. And so I think that it's incredibly important, for no other reason than your own sanity, to define for yourself when you're going to stop, either because you failed or because you've nailed it. That's basically what my job is. I find crunchy problems to save the developers that I work with time. I reckon I probably spend about 80% of my job defining problems, and that is fine if you have a competent development team. I can spend the remaining 20% of that time sitting down with my developers, and it still saves them time not being pulled off. Having to talk to stakeholders. In the organisation that I'm working in, we actually kind of isolate the developers from having to deal with stakeholders at all. So I am the only person that they are allowed to talk to, and it's my job to basically transmit all of these different inputs into one streamlined thing that they can process. So that is basically my summary. Invest in problem definition. It is something that is worth investing the time in. Write an epitaph or two for success and failure, for external people, and for yourself personally. And my final closing point is that why this talk is about tech translation is that if we find a way to talk to people in human language about problems, we generally end up focusing less on solutions and more on like really clearly defining what the problem is. because I would far rather somebody came to me and said, Lucy, you know, I've got all these researchers, they're spread all around the world, they email me their reports once a month, I can't tell what's missing, I can't tell who I need to chase them. I need a distributed workflow management system, and yeah. So that is basically my concluding, point. Talk about problems, categorize problems in human language.
Okay. Wicked and crunchy.
Wicked and crunchy.
On time. We have a chance for one short question now, and then we'll do some more questions at the end. Anyone have a quick question? Otherwise, we'll move on.
What's the crunchiest problem you've ever had?
So, for those who didn't hear, what's the crunchiest problem you've ever had?
Crunchiest problem I've ever had. Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, I think that the crunchiest, interesting, the most interesting problem that I've ever had. I'm currently trying to sort out vaccine supply chains in Nigeria, and it's really like when you ask why they have all of these problems, working out what is going wrong, you very quickly run into a couple of problems that are clearly not solvable by technology. That there's kind of the incentives are totally in the wrong place. But then you have some which are like very, very crunchy in the sense of they're collecting data to work out where the problems are going wrong by kind of using open data kit, and they're collecting it by mobile phone. And the form is just wrong. Like, the form is wrong. It is asking the wrong questions, and you're never going to be able to. And they're asking for validation on all of these fields that just aren't very important. And so it's pretty crunchy because you can see. If you don't ask the right questions, you're clearly not going to be able to. Not very exciting answer, sorry.
Great. So our next panel is ready. So I'm going to introduce you to Alice and Ben.
Hello.
Who are going to talk about 360 Giving.
Talk about 360 Giving. Has anyone heard of 360 Giving before? One has. Thank you, because it's helpful to see that. I can just about see you at the back. Has anybody worked or has anything to do with the charity, voluntary, community sector before? A few. Okay, cool. So there's quite a few who don't as well. So I'll just talk a little bit about some of the context too. First of all, to introduce ourselves. So I'm Alice. I work at Nesta. That's my day job. But I sort of also moonlight on this project. So my alleged 20% time, which actually turns into something. I don't tweet this, but probably more than it should be on this project, because I really love doing it, and it's about sort of changing the way funders use the data that they gather and trying to make that more useful and usable. And Ben, as well, I don't know, do you want to just say because you're here. I don't want to speak for you and say this is Ben and this is all.
So I'm working on the more technical side of 360 Giving. Kind of just starting recently since the past month or so, doing some of the technical work on 360. So I've not got any slides in this yet, but I'm possibly going to be fielding any technical questions people have about it.
Yeah, and Ben's been really game. I like standing up so I can see you better, but Ben's been really game to just come up and be here to answer any of the technical side of things, because he's been working on the development. So I'm going to explain a little bit about what it is and why we think a data standard is really important for funders to look at to improve their work in the future. So it's something that's been put together by originally Indigo Trust, who are a funder that work in Africa with technology projects. And when they came to look at what they could fund around the corner from their home in central London, they found that they found it easier to work out what was happening in other countries than what was happening around the corner, because people are very siloed in the way that they manage their data about funding community projects of different kinds. You have to go to individual funding bodies to look at everything separately. So, you know, it doesn't make sense. Particularly in a sector which operates on very sort of tight margins, you need to make the most of your resources, and at the minute it's very wasteful. So Indigo knew that I was interested in this, and they also knew that some of the folks at Big Lottery Fund and Nominet Trust were also interested in looking at this further. So we got together and put together some ideas around how to work with domestic grant makers in the UK, mainly UK focused, to get together, publish their data, and come up with a standard way of describing that. So what happens at the minute in the sector looks a bit like shoveling shit, basically. I mean, it kind of takes a long time, it's hard work, it's kind of smelly, and you have to go digging around in archives to try and find out what's actually happening when you want to understand, say, a given area. Like, say, if you want to work on child poverty, you can sort of know, well, I think I know who the main funders are, I'll go and speak to them and get their information, which is probably a year or so out, you know, out of date, because it sort of happens in cycles, which are quite long. So, it, you know, even the results you end up with are quite inexact. So people, therefore, spend a lot of time, not that I'm saying it's old-fashioned, might be a little old-fashioned, getting together and talking, you know, about what they're doing, or, you know, within their programmes, these funding bodies. They literally get together face-to-face and they will have conversations that aim to update each other on what's happening. It's not, you know, exactly giving them the best chance of understanding, you know, in an up-to-date way, how to make the most out of their funding. So what we'd like to do is change the way these conversations happen, give them a good set of data and information that's quite up to date, you know, not asking for miracles, but just more up to date than a year or so old, to begin that conversation that they're having now, from a new base point, so that it's kind of taking that information level that they're starting at up a step. Okay, they're still going to get together and have conversations. That's just part of how they work. It's going to take a while to change the whole sector, but we want them to have better conversations based on real time information. It was inspired by IATI, which Ben's worked on in the past. Has anyone, just out of interest, heard of IATI as well, just to give a feel for... Okay, so it's a standard for mostly aimed... It's a data standard looking at open data publishing across international aid donors. It came from the problem that, you know, people feel like aid's very lacking in transparency, don't know where that money goes, and there's cascades of aid in international aid sectors. So you get a huge whack of massive donation going in to a country level, and then it sort of filters down through quite a lot of levels, so people don't really know where that money went. So IATI was sort of beginning to look at that problem, trying to define it and standardise it using sort of data standards. And I like this sort of aspiration. At the minute, there's transparency in Nairobi, but not in Norwich. So we want to, you know, use 360 giving to maybe emulate some of what IATI is trying to do and succeeding in parts to do, to try and bring that to the UK funding community. So it's not like funders don't have data. They have a ridiculous amount of data. They publish, they get their grantees to report. You know, I can say this because if you hadn't realised at the beginning, everyone involved in this is a funder, so we can be quite critical of ourselves, I think. We get a lot of information from the people we grant to, and we don't do enough with that information, in my opinion. A lot of it is, you know, reporting, and it's done in a format and in a way that makes it very hard to extract value from it. So there's a lot of PDFs around, there's a lot of hard copy reports around with useful information that's just not being used. So it's not through a lack of data, it's not coordinating that data, not standardising it, repeating the work over again. It doesn't need to be repeated. First thing funders say, can we put it on a map? They just really want a map of everything. And I'm just like, you can have a map, but there's probably more useful things we can do with the data. But, you know, we'll make a map, because everybody wants one, don't they? They're like seeing pins in the map. But we want them to understand a picture of their activity, not just geographically. We want to understand things like, you know, specific things, like in a certain sector where we know that certain interventions work really well, say early years and poverty for children, you know, being quite a good example, where there's a lot of evidence. We could really drill down into the data and try and understand, is the money being spent in a way that's achieving the outcomes that funders want to see? At the minute, it's very hard to do that beyond looking at one individual fund.
And Norwich, of course, is blank.
Yeah, nothing in Norwich. God, that's an error. There's always somebody, isn't there? Just ignore that. Yeah, at the minute, Norwich is blank, but it's going to be packed with stuff very soon. The other thing is sector research. That's also based on this data, which is out of date. So can we make the research, the quality of the research across the sector? If you think about charities, which I do, like, it should be like a marketplace. So funding bodies putting money in, results coming out of the other side, in theory. That is how it should work. If you were going to be a new investor in any marketplace, you want to understand the dynamics of it. At the minute, the work being done on that is backdated based on old data. So we need a much more up-to-date understanding of what's happening. So for people doing studies like this one here, which is looking across the top 300 givers in the UK, the context of that needs to be improved, updated, and just made much easier to deliver that kind of research for the sector. What do we want? We want all sorts of things. We want the charities and foundations and grant makers to report data to agreed standards. We want to really create clarity for grant making bodies, just to show the basics. At the minute, we don't have that. Who's funding what? What's happening? For public bodies like lottery funds, we want transparency there as well. Private grant makers, you know, it's their opt-in to transparency as a value. That's, you know, in the UK, that's how it works. They can opt in to these kinds of things. For the statutory bodies, it's much more of a, you know, compulsory thing, and we want it to make it much easier for them to be transparent and accountable. And most of all, we want this to work better, because at the minute, that system is just not quite working as well as it should be. There's some stuff happening. You can go and have a look at GitHub and see what's going on there. You get a sort of full range of the different things that are happening with the development team. And we've got lots of people, I've got to update this slide, we've got lots of people up now on the registry with data. We've got, I think it's about 27, 28 up on there now who are putting their data in. We're trying to make it very simple for people to understand. You know, a lot of funding bodies just don't, you know, they maybe have used Excel, they maybe have used Access. They don't have a data expertise in-house. We're trying to keep it extremely simple and providing support for them, a bit of hand-holding, publish it into a spreadsheet. We'll then think about JSON and what developers need afterwards. So we're trying to make it step-by-step and easy. And last but not least, definitely not least, so 360 is going to focus on the quality and the basics, getting this information out there, getting people publishing. What we know we're going to need is tools and analysis quite quickly. So funders putting data in, we'll see the value of bothering to do that and bothering to get involved. So we started putting a thing together called, which will be not launched yet, but it's going to be called 360 Labs, and it's going to put in a whole range of different examples of what you can do with the data. For anything from demonstrator projects, which are very much sort of just mock-ups, to actual working prototypes. So we've got a range of things in the pipeline that we're talking to people about at the minute. This is just an example of something that kind of blew funders' minds when we showed it to them, which was just put all the data into a visualizer and then show what the overlap was between funding, which they couldn't see before in a clear way. They had to do a lot of work to get there. This data is a bit out of date now, so like, yeah, there's always a funny one or two. I'm trying to think. It was Sport Northern Ireland and Creative Scotland. We wanted, you know, I think, is it called Northern Ireland? No, it was Arts Council, Sporting. I can't remember, but there's basically Creative Wales and, you know, sort of Sporting. And we were just like, why the hell have they got grants in common? And they were like, yeah, why have we got grants in common? What's going on? So they were all fascinated to go in and have a look, and some university was to blame. We don't intend to become a product design agency. We're going to be thinking about this for labs. If people have ideas or things they want to think about, there will hopefully be some seed funding happening to get some of these projects off the ground. You might have ideas we haven't even thought of. We want to just give you a few examples of things that are happening in the States, which you might be interested to look at. No, we've only got a few minutes left. Water access, sanitation and hygiene is a really well-defined area where there's evidence to show that interventions lead to certain outcomes. So in the States, they've been working on a data collaborative specifically to share data on that. There's not as much openness as I would like to see on it, but they're also working, you know, partly on open data and partly on stuff behind the scenes to try and work out the impact of the funding. The same on another specific area, blackmail achievement. There are other tools that, you know, sort of different people are starting to pull together. A lot of it's aid-based. ACFO is one of them. And in the UK, Beehive is an early stage tool that's aimed at helping grant seekers target their applications more effectively. And all of this uses funder data. There's a lot of issues and there's a lot of things to work on. And I'm not going to go into them now, I think they'll come up in the Q&A, but we're very much aware that there's a lot of issues and things to work on, but we don't think that's a reason not to do it. I think if we don't innovate on data for this sector, they're going to waste money and time, they're going to miss tricks that they, you know, sort of like fairly easy things that they could be doing to just to make more value from the data, and you'll have more of the same problems. So I think people need to get together and work on some of these problems together to try and make a difference, really. So that's my contact info if anyone wants to take part, and we'll do some questions after.
We can do one quick one, a very quick one, whilst Paul gets set up.
He has a couple back there. Black gentleman in the
blue
shirt.
We just take one now. At the back.
I think this is absolutely great. I know the guys at the foundation that are really working on you on it. Charities and charitable foundations are generally a bit kind of crossy and old school. What's the kind of number one reason that you get for people going, oh no, we don't really want to be involved?
We don't want to be involved in it.
Yeah.
Do you know, I'm not just saying this, we've had a weirdly surprising amount of people just wanting to be involved in it. I've had very few people not saying the opposite, which I was shocked at, because I thought it would be the other way. But the kind of objections people have come up with are things like, what about reputational stuff, things we don't want to be out there in public, or we're worried about privacy, like maybe we've got personal addresses in our data. And with those things, we, you know, help to reassure them that if people wanted to dish the dirt on them, the data's actually, a lot of it's already there in their annual reports anyway. If people wanted to dig into it, they would probably go and get them and do that, which is sort of a half reassurance, because, you know, it might still happen. And then on the sort of privacy stuff, I mean, there are practical things we can do to help with the data. So there's lots of solutions that we're able to offer them there. But I've been really surprised, positively surprised at the response that we've had.
Okay, awesome. I think it's great to see this coming on. I remember a conversation about 4 years ago when I was a grantee, a receiver of a grant, and oddly enough, it was funded by Nominate whilst I was working in Nesta, at the same time I sat on the Data Standards panel, and we had an interesting conversation then, so it's really nice to see something happening.
Yeah.
That's enough of me mimbling along. Paul now is going to talk about the cult of equity.
Enigmatic slide. Yeah,
that should be on now.
Is that working now? Yeah, there you go. Hello, I'm Paul. So, a bit of an enigmatic title, a bit cryptic. I don't really know who most of you are, obviously, because we've only just met. How many of you work in the private sector for a venture capital-backed, angel-backed, an organisation that has taken investment from an external source? Four of you, okay. How many of you got share options? Two of you, okay. Three of you. Probably going to make you cry. If you want to come and talk to me afterwards, I'll give you some counselling. So, my background is I've been a startup CTO in several different companies, worked in about half a dozen different companies. What I'm going to talk about is, first of all, how the tech work culture is kind of broken. Most of the innovation, most of the interesting stuff that goes on, there's lots of interesting stuff going on in the voluntary sector, in the open sector, whatever. But it's all built effectively on tools that have come from venture capital, from startups and what have you. And I'm sure that some of this culture probably seeps into all of the other sectors as well. And it's that culture where it's 60-hour work weeks, it's always on call, it's everything has to be done quickly. The whole ethos around agile is around being able to go very, very quickly. Not really any time to sit back and analyse and think about technology problems in a serious way. And it's kind of seeping across the whole of the tech sector. Everyone who's a developer kind of is starting to feel this, most of you will probably feel this. If you don't, well done you. You probably work in academia or something like that, and good luck to you. Originally, when I submitted a talk, I was actually going to talk about how software developers needed a trade union, which is ridiculous because we earn, on average, about three or four times the national average salary. And what I realised, it was actually... Click.
I think we might turn this off.
Yeah, you may as well. I'm quite loud.
I think the recording devices are going to pick it up.
It should be fine.
Just annoying, sorry.
So originally it was about how we need like trade unionism and how we need to think about employee rights. I realised it was actually just this culture. This culture of everything needs to be done now. Your weekends are sacrificable for the needs of the organisation. Your evenings are sacrificable. Family life, while difficult, possible. Social life, you don't need one. Why do you need a social life? We have a football table in the corner, right? So that kind of culture, I thought, is quite broken. And I started to analyse it. I started thinking, well, why is that broken? And is there a way to fix it? And, of course, the reason why that culture is broken is it comes from here, Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley, everyone loves Silicon Valley because they see maps like this and they go, this is amazing. I used to work on a project in Manchester, and I've worked with projects in Leeds and in the southeast, where the mission of those projects has been to create the Silicon Valley of Europe. They want to emulate this. They go, this is what we want. And there seems to be this attitude that if you want this, tens and tens of billions of dollars worth of net worth creating within a local economy, you emulate the culture. Because it's the culture that did it. What else did it? It must be the culture. It must be the long hours. It must be, you know, that kind of lust for money must be what did it. So they go, right, well, we'll copy that then. There is a problem with that, though, which is that Silicon Valley is built around the need to go very quickly because the people in charge of Silicon Valley, the guys around Sand Hill Road, the venture capitalists, require very rapid returns on investment. They're not really interested in solving problems. They're interested in getting very rapid return on investment. They've got money that they've borrowed from someone else. They're going to churn it through the system, get a return on it, take 2% management fee, give the rest back. And that's the entire culture. And as a result, they're not really thinking about how to solve interesting problems. They're not really interested in the bigger problems we see in society. They're just interested in going very, very quickly. And they also have a fundamental problem, is that they have a political philosophy, which, if you read nearly every interview or biography of every venture capitalist, this lady turns up. Does anyone recognise this lady? Ayn Rand, right? Ayn Rand, who wrote Atlas Shrugged. Here are some brilliant quotes to show you how wonderful she is as a lady. She's basically, she was a bit of a dick. I mean, there's no doubt about it. If any civilization survived, it is the morality of altruism that men have to reject. The morality of selfless interest in other people's well-being. Get rid of it. Just get rid of it. You don't need it. Achievement of your happiness as an individual, is the only moral purpose of your life. And the question isn't who is going to let me, it's who's going to stop me. Every single venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, and most of the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, will quote Ayn Rand at you. If you ask them about what drives them, if you ask them about their philosophies, about their religion, their morality, Atlas Shrugged always comes up in nearly every interview I've ever read. I say, well, it's a free market, you know, but that's, you know, who cares, so what? I'd say, yeah, this stuff matters. The way we organise our businesses, the way we organise our innovation, the way we organise our economy is important, it is political. And to say, well, what we'll do is we'll emulate this mindset, which is no one really matters apart from the return on investment. Go as quickly as you can. Screw the weekends. Screw work-life balance. I think that's a problem. Here's another character that some of you might recognise, the anti-Arandian, if you like, Karl Marx. He said history repeats itself, first as tragedy, second as farce. The reason why I mention that is because, of course, all of these issues existed during the Industrial Revolution. Exactly the same issues that we are seeing today in the modern venture capital world, within the tech community, existed probably more physically arduously in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. So Marx went and, you know, got hooked up with Engels and went, you know, let's try and think about a moral framework for actually governing the way we do business. Now, I'm not a Marxist. I'm definitely not. I'm a company director. I've had share options in too many companies to mention. I'm about to go and start work for a new job in a company that's raised tens of millions in venture capital. But what I'm trying to convince you is that the system that we have at the moment, this culture that is dominating the tech community globally, is a political system. It has a monopoly on the ideas, and maybe it's worth challenging those ideas. So, most of us didn't get into tech to make money. In fact, by the raising of hands before, the vast majority of you are far more interested in bigger ideas than money, and that's fine. I'm not trying to say that, you know, venture capital should be torn apart. I'm not trying to say that if you want to go and work for share options, that if you want to go and do a startup, that you know, that's a problem. That's entirely up to you. I'm just saying that there is an opportunity to think about these things, and I think we don't think about these things. So, those of you with share options, I will sit down with you afterwards and explain to you why they're about to be worthless. But basically, this is generally a kind of a summary of how the current system works. You start off, you get 5% share options and they're worth nothing. You take some seed money and you go, oh, I've got £4,500 worth of share options. You go to a Series A, you go, oh, I've got hundreds of thousands. You get to Series B, you go, oh, I've got millions. And then because of preferential liquidity, you end up with nothing, right? So that's how the current system basically works. So you're working all of these hours, you're making these sacrifices, and you end up with virtually nothing, not always completely nothing. Over my career, I've probably been told that my share options were worth 8 to 15 million. And I'll tell you, you know, because we're all friends in here, I've actually walked away with about 30,000, right? So you get something, but it's certainly not 15 million, right? One of the alternatives I think is quite interesting is actually look at the corporate structure. Instead of having an external investor who comes along and says, I'll take a load of equity and you know, shares, and I then own you, and I'm then going to tell you how you've got to run your business, etc., etc. You have a system instead where you create an LLP. LLPs are how most accountancy firms work, it's how most solicitors firms work, quite a lot of GP surgeries, dentist surgeries, etc. It's where a bunch of professionals come together, they work together on a project, running an accountancy firm or running a solicitors firm, and they pay the gains of that organisation equally to each other. They pay dividends. It's not particularly tax efficient, but that's not the point. The point is that by changing the culture of, and the structure of that organisation, you completely change the tempo, and you change the way that you speak to your employees. The employees have a career path. They can make partner. It's no longer about trying to take some equity. It's no longer about trying to find a 10-time multiple or a 100-time multiple. You're trying to find a way of building a sustainable business that's still going to be there in 10, 20, 30 years' time, not can I get Google to buy me in 5? And so it completely changes the culture. So that's one alternative. The other alternative that probably most of you are familiar with is co-ops of various forms, social enterprises, CICs, IPSs, etc. Often considered a little bit dated as a corporate structure because of the background of the cooperative society of the northwest of England. But John Lewis makes this work, Waitrose make it work. They have internal councils, there's democratic accountability internally. Every single person who you see on a John Lewis shop floor gets a dividend every year, provided the company's made money, and they have democratic control of the company. Now, if a technology company were to structure itself in that way, rather than try to chase equity, how would it behave? Would it behave differently? It was an employee co-op. Or even, if it was a customer-owned co-op, what would those projects start to look like? So, open projects plus a co-op structure, just awesome, because it means that open projects, we already kind of have these as co-ops, we call them open source projects. It's just that the cooperative element is entirely intellectual property. And what I'm suggesting is you can put a legal structure around it and allow the contributors of those open projects to receive a dividend. They can actually make it pay, which at the moment is the big question about how you make a living out of open source. It's very difficult, very challenging, and we're still trying to find ways through it. And I think that would be pretty awesome if we started to look at ways of being able to add those structures. And closed projects also can work. Slightly less awesome. Awesome minus X. X is foreclosed. But if you imagine, you know, how would Google behave if they were a member or user-owned cooperative? Or Facebook? Or Twitter? How would they behave? Would they innovate differently? Would they release tools differently? Would they release their source code completely? Probably. And would we be better off as users? Probably. So this idea that the only way to build a Facebook is through huge amounts of venture capital is probably, you know, is one I think is worth challenging. So as NCK always used to sign off at the end, you know, they stole our revolution, now we're stealing it back. I think, as I say, I've worked in a lot of different startups. I'm probably going to work for others in the future. And I think I'm probably going to question the idea of raising seed money, raising venture capital. I'm probably going to start looking at alternative structures like LLPs and co-ops. And I hope if any of you are planning to do the same, you consider doing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.